As we continue to study mission strategy, it's important to consider the relationship between missions and churches. If the purpose of a mission is to establish the church in all the cultures of the world, then how does the mission relate to that church once it's established? So the first thing that we need to consider is the stages of development. What are the stages of development in church, mission church relationships? The first stage is the pioneer stage. In the pioneer stage, the first contact of the mission with the people to be reached takes place. There isn't any church. There aren't any Christians. And so the responsibility is fully in the hands of the mission and the missionary. And this requires the gift of leadership. It means that the missionary must lead. It means that the missionary is going to be doing much of the work by himself with his or her fellow missionaries. The second stage is the paternal stage. This is the stage at which the foreign missionary begins to train the national leadership. The church is coming into being. People have been converted to Christ. National leaders are beginning to emerge. They're beginning to become identifiable. And so the missionary begins to not only continue his or her ministry of evangelization, but take upon himself the responsibility of leadership training. This requires the gift of teaching. And we call this the paternal stage because the young church has a growing child's relationship to the mission. And so, although it's a paternal stage or a parent stage, the parent must avoid paternalism. That is, trying to keep the child as a child and not allowing the child to grow and mature and develop. The third stage is the partner stage or the partnership stage. And this is the point at which the national leaders come to be equals with the expatriate or the foreign missionaries. This requires a shift. It requires a change from the parent-child relationship to an adult-adult relationship. Now, this is difficult for both, but it's essential to the church becoming a mature adult. Now, all of us recognize that one of the most difficult stages of child rearing is adolescence. And here we're talking about adolescence, the shift from the paternal stage to the partnership stage, where the national leaders are coming to work as equals with the expatriates. This is a time ordinarily of great tension, just as it is in families during the adolescent period, where the definition of responsibilities are changing. And often the adolescent wants to have more responsibility, and the parent thinks that the adolescent isn't ready for that much responsibility. And so it's a give and take, and it's a very difficult stage, and it takes a great deal of Christian maturity in order to come through it well. Well, the fourth and final stage, which is where all of this is leading, is the participant stage. And in the participant stage, or the participation stage, the expatriates, or the foreign missionaries, are no longer equal partners, but they only participate by invitation. In other words, the national church has grown up, and the missionary may not be essential to that continued growth anymore. The missionary has planted the church. The missionary has helped to nurture the church and develop the leadership. The missionary has turned over responsibility, and now it's time for the missionary to move on and to continue to be active and responsible in that national church only as the national church leadership feels that the missionary is essential to the continued growth or the development or some kind of specialized ministry to strengthen the church. The fully mature church assumes leadership, and as long as the mission remains, it should use its gifts to strengthen the church to meet the original objectives of the Great Commission. Meanwhile, the mission should be involved in stage one elsewhere. It doesn't mean that the mission necessarily dies, but the mission moves on to repeat the pattern of the pioneer stage followed by the parent stage, the partner stage, and the participant stage. This looks very simple if we're thinking of a single field. Where it gets complicated is when different fields and sometimes adjoining fields are at different stages at the same time. And so the missionaries within the same mission society might not understand each other. The diagram that you find in your notes serves to make this clearer. If we think of the first era, or the Coastlands era of missions, which began with William Carey in 1792, and then was very prominent in the first years of the 19th century, we can see how these stages of development came to pass, so that by about 1865, most of the missions that had been established in the early years of the Coastland stage of missions had come to the partnership stage. The missionary leaders were turning things over to the national leaders, and they were moving toward participation. In some places, like the Hawaiian Islands, where the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions established work about 1819, by 1865, the national church had been so thoroughly planted, and there were no inland areas into which to move. I mean, an island is basically coast if it's a small island. The missionaries just went home. They called it the euthanasia of the mission. The mission died. They left everything in the hands of the national church and returned to the United States. Normally, where there is more territory yet to occupy or more people groups to enter, the mission simply moves their activity and enters into a new stage of pioneer missionary activity. Well, about the time that the first era of missions had arrived at the partnership and participation stage, Hudson Taylor and others like him were calling the church, which was located in big countries, to leave the coastal areas and move inland and begin anew in a new pioneer stage of missions. Well, the missionaries who were working in coastland areas or who were working on islands and were seeing their work at completion said, "What's this? We should be closing shop and going home. And what are they doing? Starting a pioneer stage? This is setting the cause of missions back. Don't they realize that missions have now arrived at the stage of partnership and participation? Why are they starting pioneer work? Isn't the work over? Haven't we completed it?" And so you get a lot of misunderstanding going on because people did not realize that different fields were at different stages and thereby required different kinds of church missions relationships. We find the same thing with the third era because of these periods of overlap and the confusion and conflict of missiological perspective. By the third era, which begins about 1935, the emphasis shifts from geography to culture. And no longer are you thinking of moving from the coastlands inland. I mean, once you've moved, you've covered the coast and you've covered inland, you've covered the country. But because of the insights of people like Cameron Townsend and Donald McGavern, we were realizing that even with all of this territory which had been occupied by missionaries in which missionary work was taking place, that there were large groups of people who were overlooked, who were hidden, who were unreached. And so the focus began to be on reaching these people groups. And that new focus called for new pioneer work. And now the missionaries who had been in the leadership during the second stage, which began back in 1865, by the middle of the 20th century, they were seeing that the work that had begun there was able to be turned over to the national leadership. And they said, "What? Still sending out pioneer missionaries? Why, the day of the pioneer missionary is over. Now that goes back to the 19th. We don't need pioneer missionaries anymore because we're in a stage of partnership and participation now." But actually, because there were new fields, you needed new pioneer missionaries. And so it's important to recognize that when you're looking at these stages, you need to understand them in the light of each field. The stages of development, the pioneer stage, the paternal stage, the partnership stage, and the participation stage, all of these are looking toward the establishment of the indigenous church. That really was the goal toward which the stages were moving. And when the indigenous church has been established, then you're really in the participation stage. Well, what do we mean by the indigenous church? I mean, this term has been thrown around a great deal. Basically, it means that when a church is self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating, it has become indigenous. That is, it pays its own bills, it makes its own decisions, and it does its own evangelizing. This was the goal. Now, this goal has some limitations. We're going to be looking at more in depth at a later time. One of those limitations is that you can have a church that's self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating, and yet it doesn't fit the culture. It can be absolutely alien to the culture because it's copied the patterns of the missionary. And so it can exist, but it will not grow greatly because its way of doing things is alien to the culture. And the people of the culture don't really see the church as being a part of their culture or belonging to them. But the other thing that can happen is that you can have a church that's self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating, and it can lack missionary vision. It can see itself as responsible only for the evangelization of its own people and have no vision whatsoever for regions beyond or for people beyond their own group. So those are some of the limitations of the concept of the indigenous church, but nevertheless, the concept of the indigenous church is very important, and it has played a vital role in the history of missions and in the strategy of missions. There are some names with which you ought to be acquainted when we study the matter of the indigenous church. And I've selected four. The first of these is Henry Venn. Henry Venn was an Englishman. He lived between 1796 and 1893. He was the head of the Church Missionary Society, which is the more evangelical mission arm of the Anglican Church. He was one of the first people to insist that the goal of missions was to establish an indigenous church and to recognize that the purpose of missions was not to have the missionary always in charge. The mission was not to be perpetual, but it was to result in the establishment, it was to give birth to a national church. Let me read one of his statements. Although it contains some outdated terms, it does sound strangely modern. He writes, "Regarding the ultimate object of a mission, viewed under its ecclesiastical result, to be the settlement of a native church under native pastors upon a self-supporting system, it should be borne in mind that the progress of a mission mainly depends upon the training up and location of native pastors, and that, as it has been happily expressed, the euthanasia of a mission takes place when a missionary, surrounded by well-trained native congregations under native pastors, is able to resign all pastoral work into their hands and gradually relax his superintendence over the pastors themselves till it insensibly ceases. And so the mission passes into a settled Christian community. Then the missionary and all missionary agencies should be transferred to the regions beyond." Now the language is somewhat outdated, but even in the early years of the 19th century, Henry Venn was one of those pioneers who saw the importance of establishing indigenous churches. In the United States, his counterpart was a man by the name of Rufus Anderson. For nearly half a century, Rufus Anderson was the leader of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, the first mission agency which was established in the United States. He lived from 1796 to 1880 and is perhaps the most influential missionary strategist of the 19th century in the United States of America. Still another person who has had great influence is Roland Allen. Roland Allen was an Anglican who served as a missionary in China in the latter years of the 19th century. He was concerned over the missionary methods that were being employed and felt that they retarded the development of the church because they kept too much in the hands of the missionary. He felt that the church was unnecessarily stagnated in the paternal stage. He wrote a book entitled The Spontaneous Expansion of the Church. and believed that God meant the church to expand spontaneously once it had in its possession the Word of God and the Holy Spirit of God, and believed that missionaries needed to free the church to expand spontaneously. Another famous book of his is entitled Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours, and he pleaded for a return to those missionary methods which were so widely used in New Testament times. For a while, his counsel was not heeded. But then at mid-century, his books, which had gone out of print, were reprinted and are still in print and still provide valuable insights into the growth and the development of the church and of the relationship between the church and missions. John Nevius was a Presbyterian missionary in China, but he's more famous because the Nevius plan, which he developed, was employed more rigorously in Korea than in China. In fact, many credit the Nevius plan for laying the foundation of the enormous church growth which is currently taking place in Korea. Although he set this plan forth in an entire book, albeit a brief book, we can summarize it in simply six steps. First, he said, let each convert abide in the calling wherein he was called. Christianity is seen as a new way of life for ordinary men. In other words, rather than immediately pulling new Christians out of their culture to train them in Bible schools for vocational Christian service, he said, let the converts stay where they are and live out the Christian life in their context. Second, trust unpaid lay leaders. Trust elders and teachers to shepherd the little flock. In other words, don't put a missionary in charge. You don't necessarily have to put a Bible school graduate in charge. But let the leaders who are chosen by the people receive the training they need without leaving their jobs, without leaving their homes, without leaving their communities, and let them shepherd these many little flocks, these little congregations. Third, let the church meet in the homes of the members. In other words, let's not pour a lot of mission money into building big churches. Let the people meet in the circumstances they can afford as they grow. As their economic power increases, let them then build the kind of buildings that they need to carry on their work. But let them begin by meeting in the homes of their members. Now, you see what's happening here. He's developing a pattern which is infinitely reproducible. You don't have to worry about the work extending only as far as the money reaches, which is what happens if you don't use an indigenous pattern. If you don't use an indigenous pattern, then you only have so much money to build so many churches and to pay so many native evangelists and to support so many missionaries. But if you develop a pattern that's infinitely reproducible, the church can expand just as far as the Spirit of God will take it. Then fourth, let the church meet in the homes, or third, let the church meet in the homes of the members, and fourth, let the church be supervised by paid evangelists or helpers and by the missionary himself. In other words, you have many of these small flocks which are entirely self-supporting. But in order to have some relationship one with the other, it is necessary that there be some kind of supervision. So he encourages these small congregations to take up offerings in order to pay for those who would superintend the work and exercise oversight. And he believed that the missionary should continue in the role as one of the superintendents to set an example and let the people know that the missionary is concerned with the planting and development of the church. And then sixth, new churches are to be planted by existing churches rather than to be planted by missionaries. He said, as far as possible, let's get the churches starting new churches and we can continue this indigenous movement. Well, once the indigenous churches are established, then how are missions going to relate to these established churches? Generally speaking, there's two ways that missions relate to established indigenous churches. One is called parallelism, and the other is called fusion. The first of these, parallelism, in this relationship, the mission sees itself as a foreign, temporary operation involved primarily in evangelism to initiate churches and other ministries. Parallelism is supportive of the church, but it does not involve itself in the administration or financing of local churches. Missionaries work under an administrator of the mission, usually a field director. And parallelism, that is, that here's the church and here's the mission, and they don't merge, they don't fuse, but they remain separate. It has some advantages. Now, the advantages of this is that it results in more satisfactory missionary placement, because it's the missionary who is it's the mission who is assigning the missionary to his ministry. And because the mission usually comes out of the same culture as the missionary, and they understand where the missionary is coming from, you often have a more satisfactory placement. The other thing is that this relationship of parallelism keeps the mission from getting involved and bogged down in all of the internal affairs of the church or the denomination or the church association which has been established, and the mission remains free for its primary task, which is the work of evangelization and to carry on outreach into new peoples and new cultures. Nevertheless, parallelism has some disadvantages. There's always the danger of paternalism because of this separation of the church and the mission. And because the missionaries are not under the national church, but always under the foreign mission, there is the danger that the missionaries get isolated from the culture and from the national church, because they're not responsible and accountable to the national church, and that they think of themselves as foreigners, and they don't really identify closely enough with the national church and with the culture. And then third, it means that because the mission is always responsible for evangelization, the national church may say, well, that's their responsibility. Starting new work is their responsibility. Planting new churches is their responsibility. And so the church turns inward upon itself. And they say, well, it's our job to administer the existing churches. That's what we'll do. And we'll let the mission worry about evangelization. And that usually means the stagnation and maybe even the decline and death of the national church, because it's focused inward rather than outward. And then sometimes what you get is, with this kind of parallelism, since the mission has foreign funds upon which to draw and the church may not have foreign funds available, it means that you get a rich mission and a poor church. And that becomes very apparent and very painful for national Christians. So here you've got institutions, you've got schools, you've got missionaries at one standard of living, and you have the national churches at another standard of living. And the fact that the mission seems to be better financed than the churches gives the people the ideas that the institutions are more important than the churches. So although parallelism has some strong advantages, it also has disadvantages. The same is true for the other model, which is called the fusion model. In the fusion model, the mission ceases to exist as an administrative body in the overseas country, except for such projects as schools or educating missionary children. All the assets and the properties are transferred to the national church, whose leaders determine the work which a missionary is assigned and whether he or she will be asked to return after his furlough. And there are several large churches and missions in the two-thirds world countries that have merged their administration and their work in this way. Now, this has some advantages. The advantages are that you have more of a sense of partnership. Wherever you have fusion, there's more of a sense of partnership. And it tends to awaken trust in the national church, because they understand that the mission is going to turn things over to them. And because the process of nationalization is very upfront, it often results in the development of a high quality of national leadership. But it too has some disadvantages. It may result in unsatisfactory missionary relationship, because the national church doesn't really understand the missionary very well and may place him at areas where they sense there's need, but which don't fit the gift of the missionary. And this can result in a certain amount of frustration on the part of the missionaries. And you can have a result of the loss of missionary vision, because the national pastors get involved in all kinds of administrative tasks. They're running the schools, they're running the clinics, and pretty soon they don't have time to run the churches anymore. And so the churches suffer. Both parallelism and fusion are widely employed. Both have significant advantages and disadvantages. And whichever you choose, you need to learn to live with the advantages and seek to overcome the difficulties and disadvantages. There's no one easy solution to church missions relationships. Now, it's important to recognize that there's the relationship of the home support structure to the field result structures. The important thing to recognize here is that what a mission looks like at home may not be what it looks like on the field. We call these structures vertical and horizontal structures. A vertical structure would be like a denomination, which as it establishes churches in a different culture or a different country, creates an administrative establishment very much like the home church. It's almost like McDonald's establishing franchises all over the world. And of course, there is cultural adjustment. But denominations like the Assemblies of God, like the Church of the Nazarene, are very liable to establish field structures that are very much like the home structures. Then you have home structures that are entirely vertical, like the Missionary Aviation Fellowship. They're interdenominational. Their missionaries come from all kinds of denominations, and they're in a very specialized service ministry. And so when they go overseas, their structure is very interdenominational, and it serves everybody, serves all the denominations, because it's a service ministry. Then you have those agencies which are like in the Interdenominational Foreign Missions Association, which are service ministries or church planning ministries, but they're interdenominational. Their missionaries come from all kinds of denominations. But when they establish those overseas, they may establish structures that are basically interdenominational service missions which are seeking to serve everybody. But often, interdenominational church planting missions establish not interdenominational entities, but they establish denominations or church associations. So here's the Latin America Mission, which is an interdenominational agency, but it establishes the Association of Bible Churches of Costa Rica. Or the Africa Inland Mission, which is an interdenominational mission society, but it establishes the Africa Inland Church. And its structures in Africa are church structures, and it is a specific denomination. So as you relate to missions, as you support missions, as you consider missionary service, be sure that you're aware of what not only what the home structure is like, but what the field structure is like, so that as you relate to it, you can understand it better. It's very important in the strategy of missions that we have a clear understanding of church mission structures.